You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to Issues Etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues Etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
There's always two sides to every story. We can straighten this out if we'll take time. Two sides to every story. You tell yours, and I'll tell mine.
When you look at modern journalism, you read the stories, and if you were just had a little bit of education in journalism, most of us did in college. We had to take the obligatory Journalism 101 course. You learned about the who, the what, the when, the where. And then, of course, included in that list of questions was why. The why gets bigger and bigger, it seems, in modern journalism. It seems to be biased in favor of, say, in a lot of cases, the guilty party. We're going to talk about false charity in modern journalism. Joining us on this Wednesday afternoon, Rebecca Curtis, pastor's wife and mother of seven children. She has a master's degree from Concordia Seminary. She's co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically, and a recent column for Salvo magazine titled Morality as Story. Rebecca, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, thank you.
I guess in its strictest sense, journalism is supposed to be simple storytelling, the who, what, where, why, those kind of questions all answer. But you said that storytelling is being misused, abused in modern journalism. How so?
Journalism is a pretty broad category. There are all kinds of journalism, broadcast journalism, obviously, long-form journalism, which might include a different kind of storytelling than the kind we expect to hear in what we think of as the news. Like, if I say the news, what does that make you think of? Well, I want the things that happened today, who was involved in them, and, you know, the different factors that affected that. But I think what we're seeing more in that form of journalism, where we expect just to get the news, the facts, the who, what, when, where, why, the inverted pyramid, is we're getting a lot more why than we are of the who, what, when, where, to the point that the why really outweighs anything else, and the kind of why we're getting is very personal and subjective to an extent that it obscures the real facts of the case. And in fact, I was driving to pick up my kids from school yesterday, and I heard a story, and it was about immigration, and it was about a person who was living in violation of the laws of this land, and how scared she was, and the bad things she had experienced, and the fearful things she was facing. And no one told the story of the 300 million people in this country for whom the immigration laws that we have were made in the first place. You can't tell that story in the same way that she can tell hers. It's an unfair competition when our journalism just comes down to my story versus your story.
So, in other words, there is a, to use a much overused word, in this kind of storytelling journalism, there's a bias in favor of the guilty.
Definitely. I think this comes out of a good impulse. I don't want to say that everyone who's doing this is in pure motives. I think it's actually a good thing. I think we're concerned with remembering that even when we are speaking of criminals and offenders, that they're human beings too. They get cold at night, they need to eat every day, and that we want to make sure that they are represented fairly as people. But again, we have to ask the question, what are our news stories supposed to be telling us? If I'm listening to a crime story, I don't want to end up hearing a profile of a person who's committed that crime, such that my sympathy ends up lying with him, because we still have to factor in the victims and the laws and good order for all of society.
Can you give us at least kind of a hypothetical example of what you're talking about?
Sure. In my article, I use an example from a fictional book Sister Carrie by Theodore Dreiser. It was published in 1900. And in that book, a successful businessman is not really satisfied with his life, not so dissatisfied that he's necessarily driven to do these things, but dissatisfied enough that when the opportunity arises, he runs off with a pretty young girl. And while he's doing that, while they're running off together, he needs to pick up some cash from the office. He accidentally takes too much out of the safe, and then the safe gets locked. The key gets locked in the safe. So now he's got all this money, not all of which he has a claim on. He can't get back in, and he's got to get out of town because he's running off with this girl. And so they just leave, and they get on a train and travel a long way. Then he reads the story of the company being robbed in the newspaper, and all it says is, well, George took the money. George took all this money from the company. And he feels really hurt by that. He's like, well, they didn't explain that I didn't mean for it to happen, and I've got all this stuff going on in my personal life, and I've been such a good guy up till now. It's really not a fair story. But, of course, as far as the company is concerned, and as far as the public is concerned, and especially as far as the shareholders are concerned, they got the story that matters. If he comes and tells them his sob story, they're going to say, well, sorry, bro, that doesn't mean you get to steal from us. I'm sorry things are bad for you, but you don't get to break the law, and you don't get to rob all these people who have also invested in your company. And I think that this is really useful because the story comes from fiction. There is not one living human being who gets hurt by our studying that story. George doesn't get hurt because he's not real. And the shareholders don't have to say, I am sick of hearing about all the sad things that happened to George, so he took the money. He took the money. It's against the law. He shouldn't have done it. There are consequences. Fiction is the right place for us to consider all these things, to look into human hearts, and to place ourselves into stories so that we can understand them better, but at the same time, not ask too much of victims and not exploit those human beings who do commit crimes, because we're all sinners. And so I think the proper place for that kind of storytelling is in fiction, certainly not in journalism, and to a very large extent, we have to be careful in telling our own stories in nonfiction or memoir or just in our daily lives as we speak to our neighbors. We have to be really careful because we always want to spin stories in a way that makes us look good and makes other people look bad, and that's a sin, too. That's a violation of the Eighth Commandment.
This is one of those things that once you realize it's happening in modern journalism, you begin to see it everywhere, where, as you said, the who, what, when, and where all kind of get subsumed under a big why, and it comes in crime reporting and political reporting. I mean, it's just everywhere, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, We all know, we're familiar with the maxim that hard cases make bad law. And yet, when we hear about our laws and their consequences, it seems like the illustration for that is always a hard case. Because that's how the law works. The law makes hard cases because our circumstances don't always fit neatly into these categories that we have identified and codified in law for the good of society.
We're talking about false charity in modern journalism. Rebecca Curtis is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk about how does the journalist tell the story accurately without neglecting the backstory of the guilty, as she says.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
Did you know that you can listen to our 24/7 talk and music stations using Amazon Echo? All you have to do is say, Alexa, play Lutheran Public Radio.
Lutheran Public Radio.
Or, Alexa, play Lutheran Talk Radio.
Lutheran Talk Radio.
thing. You know, there's this recognition that unrighteous mammon.
Lutheran music, Lutheran talk, anytime, day or night, on Amazon Echo.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Reformation was an attempt to answer the most fundamental questions of life then, and those questions endure today.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Who is God? Who am I? Where is God found? What does God make of us? Who is Christ? What's the purpose of my life? Why does suffering happen? All those questions remain absolutely pertinent, and the answers that were given in the Reformation are absolutely relevant today.
You can meet and hear Pastor Matt Harrison making the case for the Reformation's relevancy at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, call 618-223-8385 or visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about false charity in modern journalism. Rebecca Curtis is our guest, co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically. You can purchase and download the audio version of Ladylike at iTunes, Amazon, and Audible. Rebecca, how should this be done then if the journalist is going to tell the story accurately without neglecting, as you call it, the backstory of the guilty?
We need to do that in a way that I think one of our top priorities in doing that is to do it in a way that does not further victimize victims. Because, especially as Christians, I think we have a problem with this. We do want to be careful around the Eighth Commandment. We know that forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. There but for the grace of God go I. Those things are all intended to keep us humble. At the same time, we can almost internalize that to a pathological extent where we're being so careful about it that we do hand over every narrative to the guilty party because we think, well, this victim, why doesn't she just get past it? You know, she's really hurting his reputation by continuing to tell her side of the story. It just makes him look bad. That's the only purpose it serves. We want victims to move on, to forgive and forget, because we can't see how this is fair to that sinful human being with whom we also sympathize as sinful human beings ourselves. And it really ends up handing the reins over to a person who is not necessarily going to tell the story fairly and very often is motivated to tell it very unfairly, to spin it in his direction, to mitigate the facts, to explain why it actually wasn't that bad when he did it, and we all need to understand those things and then make our judgment about how bad that act itself really was.
You write this, getting people to make moral judgments by means of backstory is a storytelling offender's goal, for he aims not so much to have his immoral act pardoned as to the depth of its immorality denied. What are you saying?
This is, again, in that example from the book from Sister Carrie, George Hurstwood, the guy who steals the money, really thinks that if everybody just knew, if they knew the difficulties he was facing before and how the act itself of stealing was just an accident and, you know, he was pressed for time, then they would know that he's not as bad a guy as these facts make it look. He wants the attention on himself. He wants to draw attention to himself as a human being and then draw naturally on the sympathies that arises in any decent human heart to make it clear that, no, he's not a hardened criminal. He's not a thief. He's not stealing from these people to whom he actually owes so much. He thinks that that story is going to exonerate him to a large extent. So anytime we encounter a situation like this where somebody is just explaining their way out of the depth of their crime, then, again, that is a violation of the Eighth Commandment, of not dealing fairly with the facts, because anytime you're doing that, you're also silencing the victims, either by extorting their ongoing forgiveness or making them verify your own version of the story, which in reality is quite different from theirs.
So there is a positively spiritual aspect to this. I mean, we find it in journalism as kind of a feature of journalism, but it really taps into something you mentioned just a few minutes ago, and that is kind of our own, what, taking out the insurance policy against any future crimes we may commit or be found guilty of?
Right. I don't want to sound too cynical, but we all have an interest in that. When we see somebody else kind of digging for our sympathy wherever they can find it, we've all been there too. You know, you give your version of events and it sounds completely different from the person whom you've offended. And we're always caught back and forth between, on the one hand, our own desire and need for human compassion, and yet our need to defend our own rights, because sometimes we are the person in the right. That's why this becomes so difficult, because all of us have been on both sides of that situation.
It's interesting, Rebecca, in the criminal justice system, there is often a place for what they would call kind of mitigating circumstances on the part of the convicted, but it comes after the conviction. It's usually in the sentence phase of the trial where the judge or the jury is asked to consider mitigating circumstances when passing not their verdict, but the sentence, the punishment. Is that where journalism kind of goes wrong in misplacing itself in that whole process, so to speak?
Yes, I think that's a really good example. And this is something, you know, the law is the law. Either you've broken it or you haven't. Now, figuring out how to deal with a situation where a law has been broken, that's where we can factor in other circumstances and the person's character and their record up till this point. That's where those things become relevant. And I also think this is something we can see as Christians. How does our Lord deal with our sin? When Adam and Eve are in the garden, does he just, you know, say, look, I think based on this experience, we've all learned how bad this was, and they just walk away with this heightened consciousness of who God truly is, and that's the end of it. No, they will surely die, just like he said. But the punishment is maybe not what we had expected up front, right? This is the same thing the certain says. You'll not surely die. And we can see that in a way they don't. They don't die on the spot. They don't die that day. But they still die. They are still subject to the consequences of their sin. The Lord puts them under church discipline. But he also provides a way out. And in his showing mercy, it doesn't vacate justice. It still fulfills justice. He himself pays the price. He doesn't pass it on to some unaffiliated third party. Say, I don't want to be the bad guy here. Forgive you guys. It's no big deal. Moving on. No, that's not just. You can't have mercy if you've gutted justice in the process.
Rebecca Curtis is a pastor's wife and mother of seven children. She has a master's degree from Concordia Seminary, co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically, and a recent column for Salvo titled Morality as Story. You can read it. We'll have a link to it at our website, issuesetc.org, as well as her book, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Rebecca, thank you again.
Thanks so much.
Folks, the 500th anniversary of the Reformation is October 31st this year. And I know that there are going to be plenty of events observing this anniversary, but I cannot think of a better speaker to talk about the Reformation than Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a pastor and a scholar. He's going to be making the case for the Reformation's relevancy at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Attendance is limited to 400, and we've been sold out for the last 2 years. You can find out more about the other conference speakers and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Summer Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. Issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.